This is Sheila Bender, and you're listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us author Beth Alvarado, and she is the author of two books, Anthropologies, a family memoir from the University of Iowa, and Not a Matter of Love and Other Stories, which won the Many Voices Prize from New Rivers Press 2006. Recently, her stories have been published in the Southern Review, The Collegist, and New World Writing. Recent essays have also been published in Guernica and The Sun. She has lived in Tucson, Arizona for most of her life and taught at the University of Arizona. She now lives much of the year in Bend, Oregon, where she teaches prose at OSU Cascades Low Residency MFA program. She was very happy to be a guest teacher at Writing It Real in the summer of 2015, and she is the fiction editor of Cutthroat, a journal of the arts. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you.
I am pleased that you mentioned enjoying being a teacher at the Writing It Real conference in 2015, which is where we met. And it was astonishing to learn about your work and to hear you read from it and to watch you teach others something very important about writing, which, as I remember, had a lot to do with using details and the senses. And so as we talk about your writing and your writing career, maybe we could start there. Is there a pivotal moment in your writing life where you realized the importance of writing with the senses?
I think I was taught that in school, to try to appeal to the senses. I'm a very visual person, so actually my first love was photography. When I was a young mother and didn't have any money and I couldn't afford film, I started writing. And so the first thing I did was to really start describing how everything looked. And then I think the other senses just started coming into play. But for me, almost everything starts with my looking out the window and paying attention to the landscape. I think landscape is really important in my work, a sense of place.
So when you say you were taught it in school, kind of envy you, because I'm not sure I was taught that in school. It's been something to begin to really recognize how important that is in writing and how without it, without using direct and vivid imagery as opposed to summary and editorializing, there is only little value in what you write. Value, what I mean by that is that it doesn't engage you as a writer yourself. You can't continue if you're constantly summarizing. What kind of instruction did you have in school that allowed you to understand the importance of the sensory information?
I can't remember a particular moment, but I do know that I took creative writing in high school. I had this really wonderful teacher named Mrs. Christensen. But I think that for me, when I write, it's almost as if I'm dreaming. It has always been that way, and I'm recreating the world that I'm in. And the older I get, the more I can't remember numbers, I can't remember facts, but I always remember how things looked and felt and smelled. So sometimes I think it's the way that your memory works or the way that your mind works has a lot to do with how you write. So I'm sure part of it was school, but I think part of it was just that was just how my orientation to the world is a really physical and sensual orientation.
I love the analogy to dreaming, because we can't dream in summary. Dreams are never summaries.
No.
So that's a very valuable way to think about it. Thank you. At what point in your writing did you write Anthropologies, a family memoir?
So Anthropologies, I started writing that in 2003. But I have been listening. It really is a family memoir because it contains a lot of family stories. And my mother was a very good storyteller, and my husband's mother was a very good storyteller. So I had spent a lot of my life listening to their stories. I mean, I was one of those kids that hung out at the table and eavesdropped. So when I actually started writing it in 2003, I was taking care of my mother. She wasn't very well. And my mother-in-law was not very well either, and she had dementia. So I was working full-time, so I didn't have much time to write. So I just started, I thought I need to capture these little memories of theirs while I can. So that was what started the project of Anthropologies. It was an attempt at both at remembering, but also at trying to capture the process of remembering, how it feels to remember. So that's why it doesn't proceed chronologically, because we don't remember in a narrative order, and that's why it's in these little vignettes, because memory seems to me to be almost like photographic.
How did you order the vignettes?
That was the most difficult part of the book. It was very difficult. I tried to follow the way that memory goes, which is associative. So I would remember one thing, and then I would maybe pick a detail out of that and then create another scene or moment that echoed with the first one. And I think I went through 8 or 10 drafts where I would just read through, and then when the memory started bogging down or feeling like they weren't moving, then I would change things around. I felt like I didn't know what I was doing for most of that book.
Do you feel like you were inventing the structure? I mean, was it something you'd come across already?
Yeah, I couldn't find anything like it. And, you know, I mean, I found lots of really wonderful books that I had on my desk, this stack of books that were about memory, but none of them were doing quite what I was doing. So I did feel like I was inventing a new way of telling a narrative where the reader is actually the one who sees the narrative and not the writer so much.
Hmm.
Finally, at the end, when I was working with an editor, I realized that, and also a friend of mine, I realized that it had to be in 3 parts. So 1 part was my childhood. 1 part was when I married my husband and moved into his family had a large Mexican-American family, so it was like moving into a different culture, and that's where all his family stories come from. And then the 3rd part was the family that he and I created together, so I realized that each part had to have kind of like a central person, and each part had to have a central location, house, and that helped a lot, I think. I mean, I think it helped me, and I think it probably helps the reader, too, to feel grounded.
I think so.
Because the memories are not all mine. They're all these other different people's memories and dreams and everything that kind of goes together to weave a life.
Does this book have some semblance then to poems in some way?
I think it is very lyrical, and people have compared it to prose poems. They say that it feels like reading prose poems. And then other people have said, oh, it's like reading a novel because the characters are so vivid. It really is a kind of hybrid book.
How did you know when you were ready to send it out and get a publisher?
I didn't really. I had had an essay published in a small journal, and that one of the editors at Iowa, Joe Parson, read that essay, and he said, well, you said in your bio that you're working on a memoir. He said, would you send me the first 20 pages? And I said, well, the first 20 pages, I'm just going to send you the whole thing. And because the first 20 pages isn't going to tell you what the whole book's about, because it switched from my upbringing in Colorado in this very kind of Anglo-Episcopalian family to suddenly being in Tucson in a Mexican-American family. So the first 20 pages wouldn't give you a clue. But he loved the writing, and they worked with me until it was ready to be published.
Well, Beth, so that's like every writer's dream come true.
I know.
So,
yeah, I call it.
That's wonderful.
I know.
But before that wonderful occasion, before essays, you were writing stories. Is it true to say that you began as a short fiction writer?
When I was young, I thought I was a poet. And then, so when I was about 20 and I just had my first child and I was an undergraduate, I took a class from Richard Shelton, who's a pretty famous poet. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you want to write good poetry, you should read contemporary fiction. So I started reading James Baldwin, Catherine Ann Porter, and you know, shortly after that, I dropped out of school because it was too hard, so I had these young kids, and I needed to work. But so I just started reading all the fiction I could get my hands on, and then when I started writing again, it was just came out as fiction.
I have to ask you, It's a very unusual idea to me that a poet would say, if you want to write poetry, you should read short fiction. Can you clue us into what his thinking was?
His thinking was that I think a lot of times when really young poets start writing poetry, they're writing about their feelings and abstractions. So it's not summary, but it's not work that's grounded in the details of the world. That must have been another place where I realized, oh, we need we need to create this world. Mm. We need to use sensory details and visual details to create a world, no matter what you're writing, whether it's poetry, fiction, and nonfiction.
It's an important lesson, and I guess different teachers and different writers have a different way of getting to it, but that strikes me as really interesting. I know right now I am doing a lot of teaching of flash fiction or flash nonfiction in some cases, and people have a lot of trouble at times getting succinct by staying with the details as opposed to summarizing. And it's just something about writing, the act of writing, the act of having gone to school, I think makes us lean towards summary sometimes when it's the exact opposite that we have to do to tell the story.
Well, you remember last summer when we told people, everybody's going to read, but you can only have 5 minutes. You can't go over 5 minutes. So you have to pare out all the facts. They did, and they were surprised at how much better what they read was. So that was when I was writing Anthropologies. I asked this friend of mine who is a poet, I said, what is this? What am I writing? She goes, I don't know, she goes, but it's like when you press an icon on a computer and then suddenly this whole image just blooms. She goes, that's what you're doing. No section should be any longer than 4 manuscript pages. So that's why that book is so condensed and so crystallized, because for some reason I just followed her advice.
I think you followed it because it rang true to you. I'm thinking what you said about memory, the way memories come. Memories come in a flash. They are quick.
Yeah.
I love that idea of blooming from an icon. That's fabulous. Thank you for that.
Thank Barbara Culley for that.
All right. We will. Thank you, Barbara Culley.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 Port Townsend. In case you've just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is talking with Tucson author Beth Alvarado about her work and publishing in the genres of memoir, fiction, and creative nonfiction.
I want to ask you about your more current work. You've now ventured into essays that have great meaning to you.
Yeah.
And I know you're prepared to read from one of them, and I was hoping we could do that now.
This essay is called Water in the Desert. It was published in Guernica, or some people call it Guernica. I think in Spanish it's Guernica, but it's an online journal. And I did a lot of research for this essay. My husband just died in 2013, and he had liver cancer, and he was convinced that one of the things that contributed to his liver cancer was this water pollution that happened here in Tucson on the side of town where he lived. No one would really listen to him. I mean, the doctors just kind of dismissed what he said. So I decided that one of my tributes to him would be to give him a voice in the afterlife, since he didn't get to have one in life. I'm going to read from that essay. It's called Water in the Desert. When we got water from the tap, it effervesced in the glass, Fernando told me. He was talking about the water at his parents' house in Mission Manor, a new subdivision on Tucson's south side where his family had moved in 1972, just before we started dating. And sometimes there would be a rainbow lying on the surface of the water. When we called the builder, he told us it was because it was a new house. He told us to keep the water running to clear out the pipes. When Fernando talked about TCE, or trichloroethylene, I imagined dark plumes spreading underneath the ground. On maps, TCE looks like a big purple feather. From 1952 until the early 80s, workers at Hughes Aircraft and Tucson International Airport used TCE, an industrial solvent, to clean greasy metal parts of airplanes. They later disposed of the spent solvent by pouring it into open pits, directly onto the ground or into culverts, where it eventually percolated into the area's artesian wells. Fernando's family lay smack in the middle of the TCE plume, along the flight path to the airport. He had 8 younger brothers and sisters. I remember playing ball with the youngest of them in the front yard. We could hear the planes before we saw them emerge above the roof line. They flew so low that they rattled the windows. Then we saw their white shark underbellies, so enormous, the landing gear, their wide wings. It seemed as if they barely cleared the house, as if we should duck. When we were first married and I moved in with his family, I often dreamed of planes. After his family had lived there for a decade or so, people in the neighborhood started dying. Clear patterns didn't emerge, but sometimes several people in one family would die. Finally, the city tested the water. Some estimates showed TCE contamination at 1,000 times the federal health standards. They closed wells. There were court cases. Red lines were drawn around the housing developments. Developments where 75% of the residents were Hispanic and low income. Once the developments were redlined, it was impossible to sell those houses, so people stayed where they were. The cleanup began, but it was already too late. On Evelina Street alone, near the school Fernando's siblings attended, near Mission Manor Park where they played, and near the swimming pool where they swam in the summers, 34 cancer cases were documented. Several families now have only one surviving member.
That is a very difficult story to bear, that you would have lost your husband to such a situation. And I know, because I read the whole essay, which people can find on GuernicaMag.com, that would be GuernicaMag.com, Water in the Desert will get you there, that you tell more of the story of the loss of his siblings, of his concern for you and his children. You have a poem in there. You're writing between stanzas of a poem.
The Song of Solomon, Song of Solomon from the Bible.
Right. This essay is so rich with not only information and the sadness of a culture that is dealing or not dealing with such threats, but also with your love for him and your loss. I'm really sad to hear about your loss. And the idea that you're honoring him by bringing his voice forward, it's really, this essay is such a combination of his voice, because he speaks and it's his situation, but it's your beautiful voice in there. And in the way you read, even the facts, we hear the poet in you alive and telling the story through your senses, through playing ball, through the parks that are around, the sound of things. I really encourage everybody to go and read it. And I think that this work is in the direction of some of your recent work also, that you're wanting to get out to the public. Can you tell us about that?
So after I wrote this essay, I was doing research for part of the essay. And I met more people here in Tucson. There's a community advisory board that's been meeting for 20 years. There's a woman named Yolanda Herrera who has been really still kind of advocating for the people who've been hurt by the TCE. And then I also met a woman, Christine Krilicki, who did her work at the College of Public Health at the University of Arizona, and she's documented all these things that, if had I known her, it wouldn't have taken me 2 years to do the research, you know, because she had done it. But now we're thinking of trying to collaborate on a book together, and she had collected a lot of oral histories while she was doing the research. And so we want to do a larger book on the TCE and clean up here in Tucson, the problem here in Tucson, and include lots of other people's voices. So I'm going to meet with her next week, and we're going to start talking about how we might do that. And we're hoping to find a publisher that will publish the book in English and Spanish, because so many of the people who were affected, Spanish is their first language.
Well, the contamination of water is certainly in the news with Flint and all of that coming to the public eye, that it isn't just a problem in Flint. And your essay is obviously speaking to another way that water gets contaminated. How do you feel as a writer in terms of writing, making a difference, and your commitment to this work now?
As a teacher, especially when I was working with undergraduates, I was always teaching about literature of social witness. So this is literature that bears witness to problems that need to be addressed or solved, or just to kind of try to raise people's awareness. I think that influenced me a lot as a writer, that you wonder, well, what difference can I make, any difference in the world? I think through writing you can, and also through teaching. That, my interest in this, of course, is that I know many people who have had health problems and might continue to have health problems from this because they think that it might cause genetic damage so that future generations might be affected by it too. And then there was the injustice of the lawsuit where they closed the records. And so 1,600 people were compensated, but 47,000 people lived in the area, and they think 20,000 have had their health affected.
Wow.
So it's a huge issue.
So I just want to thank you for devoting some of your writing life to helping publicize this. While you're teaching and in the low residency program and working on this project and formulating it, are you continuing to write fiction as well?
My thing is that it takes me so long to work on a book and my mind jumps around so much that I usually work on two or three projects at once. I'm just starting the TCE project, but I have a novel that I wrote that was based on a murder trial in Tucson. And so that one, I feel like that book is finished and it's a novel. And then I'm writing another book, which is a collection of fabulous tales with a 12-year-old girl named Jillian, who is kind of like Candide. She and her mother go through the borderlands and meet all these strange people, and she can see the dead and talk to ghosts. So it has all these kind of magical realism elements in it. So I think that I get tired of reality sometimes I'm writing too much nonfiction, and so I go to the fiction to give myself the freedom of imagination.
So I have a question for you.
Both of those fiction projects are really heavily researched too. So
can I ask you a question about your imagination? You were raised in Colorado in a Protestant family, I think you said, or Christian family, and
very
Anglo. And then
you married into
a very large Mexican family. And I'm wondering if the magic realism and some of these elements of your writing are inspired by being in that culture.
I think so. I mean, I think one reason that I was so drawn to my husband and so drawn to his family and the culture was that my family was agnostic more than it was Protestant. And my father was a scientist. And so I think that I loved the idea that there was a world that we couldn't see that was influencing this world, and not in a really religious or dogmatic way, but just that there were things that we should listen to and pay attention to. We should follow our intuition. And, you know, I mean, I really do feel that the dead are still with us, and if we maybe only in our dreams. I mean, some people would call that wishful thinking, but I just kind of love, in that culture, the kind of honoring of the spiritual and the magical. So to me, that's imagination. You know, that imagination isn't totally out of nothing. That imagination comes out of our engagement with the world and with each other.
Oh, I like that. I'm going to say it again. Imagination comes out of our engagement with the world and with each other. I love that because it allows us to trust that our experiences are writing worthy. We should go for it. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you how much you do as editor for Cutthroat, a journal of the arts. It sounds like that's another big responsibility.
Well, I've always worked with graduate students. So when I was at the University of Arizona, I had some really great assistant editors that were in the MFA program there. So I'm going to do that this fall, too. We only have one hard copy issue a year, and then there's an issue that's online, and I don't have anything to do with the online issue. But the graduate students from OSU's MFA program, I'm going to teach a class in editing, and they are going to help me read through the slush pile, and we will discuss everything together. And then I also have some really wonderful co-editors that are going to help. So I don't do it alone. There's no way that I could we get sometimes 300 submissions. We can only choose six pieces.
Right. Well, that's such a fabulous way that you've organized your different tangents of your writing life, and it's very helpful to teach the younger writers how to go about this editing. So before we end, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today and telling us about your work and your life, and I hope our listeners are eager to go and find more about you and your books, I want to mention your website, which is your name, and I will say it and spell it. So it's www.bethalvarado.com, and that is BETHALVARADO.com. And I just want to, again, thank you for being here with us and for sharing your story of your writing life and your writing. Thank you, Beth.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, www.writingitreal.com/audio. In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.